In the second volume of The Principles, which Darwin received by mail at a port in South America, Lyell savages Lamarck for suggesting the contrary. It is idle to dispute about the abstract possibility of the conversion of one species into another, Lyell writes, when there are known causes so much more active in their nature, which must always intervene and prevent the actual accomplishment of such conversions. Just what those barriers are, Lyell does not say, but he is convinced they exist. There are fixed limits beyond which the descendants from common parents can never deviate from a certain type. That is why Darwin dropped the finches from two Galapagos islands into one bag. Like Linnaeus, he was well aware that different local conditions can carve a species into local varieties. He and Fitzroy had already seen evidence of that in the foxes of the Falkland Islands, and Darwin thought he saw the same thing in Galapagos rats. But Darwin did not imagine that a species would split into different varieties under the near identical conditions and skies of neighboring islands. Even if they had, Darwin did not imagine that such varieties would mean anything all that important. 9 months later, the Beagle was on a zigzag course across the Pacific and back to England. Darwin was working on a catalog of his ornithological specimens, including his Galapagos finches and mockingbirds, which all rode home with him in a very cramped cabin under the forecastle. A new thought struck him, and he jotted himself a note. At that moment he was working, alas for legend, on the mockingbirds. "I have specimens from four of the larger islands," he wrote. The mockingbirds from San Cristobal and Isabella looked about the same to him. But the specimens from Floriana and Santiago seemed different, and each kind was found exclusively on its own island. When I recollect the fact that from the form of the body, shape of scales, and general size, the Spaniards can at once pronounce from which island any tortoise may have been brought, when I see these islands in sight of each other, and possessed of but a scanty stock of animals, tenanted by these birds, but slightly different in structure and filling the same place in nature, I must suspect they are only varieties. Only varieties. If so, they would fit comfortably within the orthodox view of life. But what if they were something more than varieties? What if the mockingbirds had been blown to the Galapagos from the coast of South America and then diverged from their ancestors generation by generation? What if there were no limits to their divergence? What if they had diverged first into varieties and then gone right on diverging into species, new species, each marooned on its own island? If there is the slightest foundation for these remarks, Darwin wrote, the zoology of archipelagos will be well worth examining, for such facts undermine the stability of species. Then, in a scribble that foreshadowed two decades of agonized caution, Darwin inserted a word, would undermine the stability of species. Darwin's collections were being talked about even before he got off the boat, because he sent home letters and crates of specimens during the voyage. The Beagle docked in Falmouth in October 1836, and, with a little diplomatic prodding from Darwin, who was not the only explorer bearing plants and animals from the far corners of the earth, some of the world's most learned naturalists began poring over his finds, classifying them according to the system of Linnaeus. On January 4th, Darwin donated all of his Galapagos bird skins and other trophies to the Zoological Society of London. Within a week, specialists at the Society began talking about this new treasure trove. At the very next scheduled meeting, according to the Proceedings of the Zoological Society, the ornithologist John Gould announced that he was particularly excited about a series of ground finches so peculiar in form that he was induced to regard them as constituting an entirely new group, containing 14 species and appearing to be strictly confined to the Galapagos Islands. Gould's description of Darwin's finches made the next morning's newspapers. The London Daily Herald mentioned 11 species of the birds brought back by Mr. Darwin from the Galapagos Islands, all of which were new forms, none being previously known in this country. Soon after that, Darwin took an apartment in London. He wanted to be near Gould and the other specialists who were working through his collections. In mid-March, he visited Gould at the Zoological Society and asked about his Galapagos specimens. The sheet of paper on which Darwin jotted his notes at this meeting is preserved at the Cambridge University Library. Both sides of the paper are full of racing scribbles, which are themselves covered over on each side with one large scrawled word, Galapagos. Gould summarized what he had learned so far about the Galapagos specimens. Almost all of the land birds were new, Gould said. They had never been described before, and apparently they lived only in the Galapagos. Three of the mockingbirds were not just local varieties, in Gould's opinion. No, as Gould had already informed the members of the Zoological Society, they were separate species. This was the verdict that Darwin had conjectured would undermine the stability of species. What is more, the tame little birds that Darwin had found hopping around beneath the bushes were unique, too. They were not relatives of blackbirds, warblers, wrens, and finches, as Darwin had thought when he bagged them. They were all finches, a strangely diverse group of finches, and they were all unique to the islands. Darwin squeezed in Gould's names for them on the back of his notepaper down at the very bottom. That was the fabulous moment, not out on the islands, but indoors in a cluttered office in London. Or rather, that was one in a swift series of moments, of intellectual shocks, that set Darwin reeling as expert naturalists told him more and more about his finds. The giant tortoises are unique to the Galapagos as well. So are the marine iguanas, Darwin's imps of darkness. So are the very bushes and the cactus trees. Species after species in the Galapagos bears a family resemblance to relatives on the mainland of South America, but are clearly distinct from anything ever found there. Year after year, these revelations fanned the ember of Darwin's secret thought. To Darwin, all these species, marooned in their lonely archipelago, had diverged from their ancestral stocks and then gone right on diverging. They had broken the species barrier. Darwin's fossils from South America turned out to be exciting, too, although while he was digging them up and crating them, he had wondered if old bones were worth the work. Many of them proved to be extinct relatives of living forms. The continent of South America is the home of the armadillo, the llama, and the capybara, which is a rodent the size of a hog. Among the fossils that Darwin had found were a giant armadillo, a giant llama, and a rodent the size of a rhinoceros. These fossils helped to confirm what Lyell and other geologists had already guessed from finds in Australia. There is a law of succession that links the living to the dead, the same law that links the fossils of one stratum of rock to the fossils in the strata below. If the giants he had found in the earth were ancestors of the animals he had watched on top of it, then Darwin could read in them the same thrilling story he read in the Galapagos. Whether he followed his finds horizontally, tracing the spread of animals and plants across the surface of the earth, or vertically, tracing them down into the abyss of time, the same secret stared back at him. It was evident that such facts as these, as well as many others, could be explained on the supposition that species gradually become modified, Darwin wrote long afterward, and the subject haunted me. That spring, he made his first jottings about evolution in a red notebook he had started on the Beagle. And that summer, he opened his first notebook on transmutation of species. In the memoir that he worked up from his diary, the Journal of Researches, better known as The Voyage of the Beagle, he writes at some length about the birds of the Galapagos, especially the finches, the most singular of any in the archipelago. He notes in a famous passage that, in the 13 species of ground finches, a nearly perfect gradation may be traced, from a beak extraordinarily thick to one so fine that it may be compared to that of a warbler. I very much suspect that certain members of the series are confined to different islands. What follows next is the first published hint of his secret theory. Seeing this gradation and diversity of structure in one small, intimately related group of birds, one might really fancy that, from an original paucity of birds in this archipelago, one species had been taken and modified for different ends. Then he breaks off. But there is not space in this work to enter on this curious subject. Of the Galapagos as a whole, he concludes his memoir with this tantalizing and magnificent line. Hence, both in space and time, we seem to be brought somewhat near to that great fact, that mystery of mysteries, the first appearance of new beings on this earth. 2 years after the voyage, Darwin married, and he and his wife, Emma, took a house in London. He fell ill. His stomach was seldom right for a whole 24 hours. He suffered from anxiety, boils, dizziness, eczema, flatulence, gout, headaches, insomnia, and nausea. He spent the rest of his life pursuing his researches and writings in the bosom of his growing family, first in London, then in the rural privacy of Down, Kent. Only after his electrifying meeting with Gould had he realized how interesting the Galapagos finches might be to him, since they are by far the most numerous and the most diverse land birds in their remarkable archipelago. He had asked permission to look over the finch skins in the collections of Captain Fitzroy and other shipmates, including his own servant on the Beagle, Sims Covington. The captain and the servant had labeled their finches island by island for the ironic reason that they were not collecting the birds according to a scientific theory, they were just collecting. From their neatly labeled specimens, Darwin tried to figure out where he had caught each of his own finches, and he failed. Still, Darwin did not waste his time moaning like Lord Jim, "What a chance missed!" Even at Down House in Kent, he was able to gather enough evidence so that he could say, in The Origin, the great power of this principle of selection is not hypothetical. What Darwin developed as a living demonstration of his theory was an analogy. He studied the power of breeders. People had been shaping and molding animals and plants since before the time of the shepherds in the land of Israel. There are allusions to the practice in Genesis. There are treatises on animal husbandry in ancient Chinese encyclopedias. Breeders in England in Darwin's own time were spectacularly active, making new breeds of sheep and cattle, new varieties of strawberries and roses. The best of the new breeds were exported all over the world. British racehorses and bulldogs with fine pedigrees fetched high prices. Darwin knew that breeders could shape not only animals' bodies, but their very instincts. In The Origin, he notes that a cross with a bulldog has affected for many generations the courage and obstinacy of greyhounds, and a cross with a greyhound has given to a whole family of shepherd dogs a tendency to hunt hares. Darwin tells of one dog, whose great-grandfather was a wolf, and this dog showed a trace of his wild parentage only in one way, by not coming in a straight line to his master when called. There were some who thought that God created each kind of domestic animal and plant separately. They argued for every variety being an aboriginal creation. But Darwin knew from reading the breeders' treatises that the power lay with the breeders themselves. They called their secret the power of picking or selection. Picking the most prolific hen in the chicken coop, the fleetest horse in the field, or the best rose in the garden over and over again, according to one treatise that Darwin read, enables the agriculturalist not only to modify the character of his flock, but to change it altogether. It is the magician's wand by means of which he may summon into life whatever form and mold he pleases. The results were like creation itself. One British lord, praising the work that breeders had done with sheep, wrote, "It would seem as if they had chalked out upon a wall a form perfect in itself, and then had given it existence." Since breeders called the art of choosing selection, they called any changes in a breed that did not take place because of their conscious efforts, all of the casual, frustrating, and inexplicable changes in their flocks and herds behind their backs, natural selection. To see the selection process firsthand, Darwin took up the breeding of pigeons. In 1855, 20 years after his visit to the Galapagos Islands, Darwin began collecting pigeons in a coop in back of Down House. Though he now loathed travel, Darwin went into London to the Freemasons Tavern to meet with gentlemen pigeon fanciers of the Philopperisteron Society. He went to pigeon shows and poultry shows, he asked the secretary of the Philopperisteron Society, William Tegetmeyer, to buy pigeons and their skeletons for him at Covent Garden. "Very many and sincere thanks for keeping me in mind about pigeons," he wrote to Tegetmeyer on New Year's Day, 1856, and 2 weeks later he wrote apologetically to a neighbor, "I had meant to have sent you a line on Sunday, but quite forgot it myself. Indeed, we are all sick and miserable, and I hardly care even for pigeons, so you may guess what a condition I am in." In April 1856, Darwin stood in front of his pigeon coop with the geologist Charles Lyell. By now, Darwin had 15 breeds in his coop, including tumblers, trumpeters, laffers, fantails, pouters, polands, runts, dragons, and scandaroons. These birds were so very different from one to the next, as Darwin explained to Lyell, that if they had been found in the wild, they would have been classified by biologists as belonging to separate species, or even as separate genera, distinct groups of species. Yet all these breeds had been created by nothing more mysterious than selection. If selection could do this much with pigeons in the short space of human history, how much more could the same power do in nature in the course of millions and millions of years, in the spans of time that move mountains? Lyell was not converted by Darwin's pigeons, but he was impressed. He urged Darwin to publish something fast, to establish priority for his ideas about evolution and natural selection. On Lyell's urging, then, Darwin began the great writing project that resulted at last in his Origin of Species. He called it his big book. His working title was Natural Selection. Darwin knew better than to hang this book on the finches he had collected so haphazardly as a young man in faraway islands. He describes the finches in Natural Selection, the long first draft of his manuscript, but he does not even mention them in the final draft. Instead, Darwin begins the origin with his pigeons, including the English carrier, greatly elongated eyelids, a wide gape of mouth, the short-faced tumbler, with a beak in outline almost like that of a finch, and the common tumbler, has the singular and strictly inherited habit of flying at a great height in a compact flock and tumbling in the air head over heels. Generations of readers have wondered, behind drooping lids, why Darwin goes on so long about pigeons when his true theme is so much more exciting. Why talk about change in pigeon coops and hothouses when Darwin's subject is turbulence in the natural world? But farms and nurseries were the only place where Darwin had seen it happen, and the only place he thought human beings could see it. In Darwin's treatment of the subject, no proof is adduced that a selective process has ever been detected in nature, wrote the British evolutionists Guy C. Robson and Owain W. Richards in their influential book, The Variation of Animals in Nature, published in 1936. Throughout the work, such a process is suggested and assumed. Its actual occurrence is nowhere demonstrated. Stated briefly, the argument is as follows. Selection has plainly worked in domesticated races. Analogous results and appropriate processes and conditions are found in nature. Therefore, we may assume that selection works in nature. In short, the proof is based on circumstantial rather than direct evidence, and the mainstay of the case is the analogy between artificial and natural selection. Robson and Richards add, "It is a very unsatisfactory state of affairs for biological science that a first-class theory should still dominate the field of inquiry, though largely held on faith or rejected on account of prejudice." The fable that has grown up around Darwin and his finches is a Hollywood version of the romance of the mind. It simplifies the story by putting all those pigeons and mockingbirds in the background. "Get those birds off the set!" And it speeds up the action by making it love at first sight, an Archimedean eureka. Darwin is so impressed by the finches and their beaks that his theory of evolution leaps straight into his head. He sails away dizzy with impious visions, as if he has just tasted an apple from the tree of knowledge. In one popular account, the young man sits down by one of the giant tortoises' drinking holes and stares at the gray domes of the tortoises, rather the way the young Hamlet sits in a Danish graveyard and ponders a skull. If there are differences in the beaks of the finches and the shells of the tortoises, I must exercise extreme care to label each island's collection quite scrupulously, Darwin muses. That could be the most important discovery of my journey. What causes these differences? Aye, there's the rub. Another popular account asks us to imagine Darwin arguing his finch theory with Captain Fitzroy in their narrow cabin. Or, if you like, out on the poop deck on a calm night as they sailed away from the Galapagos, putting forth their ideas with all the force of young men who passionately want to persuade one another and to get to the absolute truth. Fitzroy dismisses Darwin's ideas as blasphemous rubbish, but Darwin hurls his notions back against the blank wall of Fitzroy's uncompromising faith as if battering down the church itself. Millions of students have been taught this fable, and thousands are still taught it every year. It has become, in fact, one of the most widely circulated legends in the history of the life sciences, writes the historian Frank J. Sulloway, ranking with the famous stories of Newton and the apple and of Galileo's experiments at the Leaning Tower of Pisa as a classic textbook account of the origins of modern science. Sulloway tried to break the spell on the 100th anniversary of Darwin's death. He published not just one, but a series of brilliant papers on Darwin's conversion and on the evolution of the legend. Yet the legend is still in wide circulation. Although Darwin himself never went back to the Galapagos, many of the naturalists who sailed there in his wake collected finches. In 1868, 460 specimens. In 1891, about 1,100 specimens. In 1897, 3,075 specimens. In the ambitious expedition of the California Academy of Sciences in 1905 to 1906, 8,691 specimens. By then, Darwin's finches had become one of the best-known tribes of birds on the planet. Just by looking at these birds, three generations of biologists felt as if they could almost see evolution in action. Once Darwin had opened their eyes to the process. But the Grants are the first scientists equipped with enough patience, stubbornness, ground support and sea support, enough computer power, airplane power, and staying power to watch the process actually happen.